developers. So we're now ready to hear the oral arguments in the Southwest Technologies case.
I'm Michael Marabello, registration number 11435. I'm representing, it's referred to variously as Alamo, Vanguard, or National Car Rental. They have a number of names that they use. The first issue I'd like to address, with the court's permission, is the issue of General Motors as a non-party. The trial court should have applied the directed verdict analysis to plaintiff's motion to dismiss the affirmative defense of General Motors' responsibility in this matter. If the court had reviewed all of the evidence in this issue in the light most favorable to Alamo, she would have found the following unrebutted evidence. Plaintiff's claimed injuries were caused by a broken trunk lid strut. The vehicle with the broken trunk lid struts only was a few months old with 19,000 miles on it. The struts had an unusually high failure rate among the national Alamo fleet. The plaintiff believes that the struts are an obvious safety item, which doesn't require expert testimony to establish defect on. And GM paid all of the strut-related warranty claims and took possession of these struts as part of an investigation of strut issues. GM's repair manual warned of the danger if struts were disconnected from the trunk lid if they're repairing broken struts. GM corrected the design deficiency, and plaintiff wrote to his employer and told him that GM agreed this is their responsibility. This case is directly analogous to Antolovich, I have trouble pronouncing that one, versus Brown. In that case, the court found that there was sufficient evidence that two different neighboring property owners may have contaminated the plaintiff's property. One was a defendant, one was not a defendant. There was enough for the jury to have found reasonably that they were both liable, or one or the other was liable. In this case, there's enough evidence in existence to find that GM is liable, or National is liable, or both of them are liable. You couldn't really argue the other way.
Mr. Mirabella, is your argument regarding non-party liability for GM based on negligence or product liability or both?
Negligence, Your Honor. And I make that point when I distinguish the holding which is relied on in plaintiff's brief on the Adams Rental case. In Adams Rental, if you look at footnote number 2, the designation set forth a products theory. It set forth failure to warn. The evidence was about a products theory. Our evidence was about negligence, and it's the difference between pattern jury instruction 14.1 and pattern jury instruction 14.8. They're different theories. So you don't need to go into the risk utility analysis. You don't need to go into who actually manufactured this part that was incorporated into a GM vehicle. You don't need to go into all those things. You simply need to say, is it unreasonable to put a part in a vehicle that can't last 8-10 months without having a higher rate of breakage than is normal?
What broke?
The struts hold up the trunk lid,
right?
And there's a little ring at the top of the strut that hooks into a nut that connects it. And the top of that ring broke off on both sides.
The testimony to that effect?
Yes. And I played with the idea of going up into my attic and finding the, I kind of anticipated that question. I ran out of time yesterday. to go up and get the strut so you could look at it.
Which witness provided that testimony?
Well, the strut themselves were a exhibit. I believe Mr. Lang testified that when he examined the strut, he found they were broken. Jason Gay, who replaced the struts and kept the struts for GM to later recover and take to their lab to look at, said they were broken. And he said he'd consistently had this problem. There were, I can't remember now if it was five or six, but there were several warranty claims, and it was an unusually high number of warranty claims because National only keeps their cars for 8 to 12 months at the maximum, usually less. They turn them back in before they have 25,000 miles on them.
Mr. Morbello, you said a couple of times two things in your recitation of the evidence in GM, which I appreciate. You said a couple of times it was an unusually high failure rate, and then I'll take one at a time. What was the evidence of that? I mean, I heard there were five out of 30,000 cars or some ridiculous number. So what is the evidence that it was unusually high, and do we know whether any of those five, it was the same car that happened to you twice? What's the evidence of that?
No, it was not the same car that had happened to you twice.
Okay.
It was five or six cars in a fleet that fluctuates between 4,500 and 7,000 over the.
Sorry to overstate the number. Okay.
And that's just for Denver. That's just Denver's fleet.
But who said it was unusually high? What was the?
Jason Gay.
Okay, and that was his testimony?
That was his testimony.
Yes. All right. And the other issue that I wanted to ask you about, you said GM corrected the design deficiency.
Yes.
I do recall that there was evidence that they came out with a new strut. Was there any evidence that when they came out with a new strut, they were correcting a deficiency as opposed to just every time somebody does a new model comes out, they improve things?
Well, both Mr. Gay and Mr. Kemp testified that the struts on the replacement struts were thicker. The rings were thicker.
But did either of them
say to be stronger?
Did either of them say that was the GM? Well, first of all, did either of them have any factual basis to say why GM made that change? And second, did either of them say that they were fixing a design deficiency? Well, I accept 100% what you just said, that these struts they all thought were better. But you said that the GM corrected a deficiency, and I'm trying to focus on what evidence was there that GM knew there was a deficiency, if any.
Besides paying warranty claims without complaining about it, taking the struts back to their lab and examining them, the problem we had was, I tried to get GM into the case on a discovery basis at least, and they were in bankruptcy at the time. So anytime we tried to talk to GM, it was... Sorry, talk to the hand. Can't respond to you. Mr. Kemp said it was not unusual for GM to improve the design of things as things went along. And while he didn't directly say it was stronger, he said it was thicker. It was obviously bigger and thicker. So did Mr. Gay. So we didn't have GM available. Otherwise, the record would be more complete.
Thank you.
And so then, can you state succinctly, GM's duty was what?
The same duty, at least, that plaintiff says that the company that rents the car is, to provide a car that doesn't have a trunk lid strut that presents a danger to the user.
Okay, and so your theory is they had a duty to manufacture a car, sell a car, put the car into commerce that has a trunk lid strut that works.
Correct.
Is there any evidence that this trunk lid strut did not work when you took the car?
When we took the car, it was operational. As far as we know, it was operational up until it came up to the gate, at which time there's a factual dispute.
So their duty then was to install an unbreakable strut?
I don't think it has to be unbreakable, but it has to be reasonably sufficient to work for several months. Now, this car, as I recall, went into, and there is an exhibit that would show that, went into service in late January of 2006.
So their duty is to provide a car that as far as the strut, because the trunk lid is dangerous, that the strut continues to work for a reasonable period of time.
Correct.
And here, your theory is it was not a reasonable period of time.
If you bought yourself a Chevy Nova, or Impala rather, and 6-8 months later, your strut broke and you got hit in the head reaching into the car for groceries, you'd go to GM and say, what the heck is going on here?
Was there any evidence, obviously other people have used this car, that's what a rental car agency is for, is there any evidence that some other user did damage to this strut? For example, I mean, I hear what you say, but it seems to me equally logical to assume, you know, a prior user was an idiot with the trunk and they pushed it up too high or broke the struts themselves. So how do we know?
Testimony on that, Your Honor.
Please.
Because I'm running out of time. When they bring it in, the person that accepts the car back from the new renter is supposed to take a look at it, notice if there's any damage. They then drive it to what's called the service department, who vacuums and washes the car. Those guys are supposed to take the car if they notice any problems with it and bring it over to maintenance for fixing. And they just write it on the windshield with a grease pen. Fix the trunk lid. In this particular case, this car was looked at twice on the day of the rental because it was returned. Someone noticed that the front seat wouldn't move back and forth, was brought over to maintenance, fixed, brought back to service, vacuumed a second time, and put on the line. And you're going to see in a few minutes, I believe, a video of how easy it is to knock this trunk lid over if it doesn't have the struts on it. It's impossible to believe that somebody would crawl into that trunk with a vacuum and not notice that. They have no upside to just putting it back on the line. They want to bring it over to maintenance and get it fixed so they can get it out on the road, because they don't want to get sued and they don't want to put unsafe cars out there. Okay, it's a big jump to say this is an unsafe car, but that's plaintiff's position. Okay, and assuming plaintiff's position that it's an unsafe car, if your trunk lid doesn't work, it's certainly more of a duty for the manufacturer than the company that's renting the car.
What's the difference between this and a design defect claim?
A design defect claim, we'd have to go into the sort of analysis that was gone into in Adams Rental. We'd have to talk about risk utility and things of that nature. I'd like to reserve my remaining time, such as it is. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Mabella. Counsel for plaintiffs, before you get started, I want to ask if you intend to divide your time, and if so, how?
Mr. Plank will have the last 5 minutes, Your Honor.
Okay.
My name's Mr. Case.
Okay, very well. I'll just try and keep that in mind that as you proceed. So you're welcome to begin now.
I represent Robert Lang, and on September 15th, 2006, Mr. Lang rented a blue Chevy Impala from Alamo Rental Car at Denver International Airport, and he went through the process, carries his luggage in, welcome to Alamo, looks at his contract, makes sure the price is what he agreed to, signs the contract. He's told, take any car in row B, walks out to row B. He likes Impalas, so he picked the blue Impala, threw his luggage in the back seat, did not open the trunk because he was saving the trunk for the sample kits that he was going to pick up from a friend. Drives to the gate. He did a walk-around inspection while he was in the lot, noticed there were scratches on the hood, told the gate attendant, Ingrid Bauer, there's scratches on the hood. She wrote that on his contract in her handwriting, scratches on hood. So no mention on the contract of any difficulty with the trunk. Lang drives over to his friend's house in central Denver. He goes to the front porch, gets the two sample kits that his friend had left on the front porch. These are cardboard boxes about 18 inches high, 18 inches wide, 3 feet long. Takes those to the car, opens the trunk, puts the two boxes in the trunk, closes the trunk lid, doesn't notice any problem, walks around, drives to Grand Junction, calls on his Glenwood Springs, I think. Calls on his first customer. Customer says, I'd like to see some samples. So he goes back to the car, clicks the trunk, pops open a crack, he opens the trunk, he looks in, and the boxes have shifted all the way to the forward part of the trunk on the drive up. So he reaches in, he grabs the first box, and as he's pulling it out, the trunk lid comes down and hits him on the back of the neck. He fell to his knees. He said he felt like his wind had been knocked out. And he's kneeling there with his head inside the trunk, stunned. And a gentleman who was on the maintenance crew...
Mr. Case, let me... I know we said you can use your time as sure. You please. We know the facts.
Okay.
And so what are the legal issues you want to address?
Well, there's... Can I show you the video, or...?
You can if you like. You know, we've all three seen it.
All right. And I don't need to waste my time and yours with that. These are what was broken, okay? The way these work, you have the trunk open, these extend, and hold it up. If this isn't in place, when the trunk lid starts down, it continues to accelerate.
Mr. Case, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Could you stand by the mic, because we won't record you if you want. Thank you.
So if you don't have the support cylinders attached, the trunk lid comes down really fast, and it can hurt you. So our position is that when Mr. Lang rented the car, he had a right to assume it was in new condition and things would work. And without these support cylinders, the trunk lid operation is unsafe.
Why isn't that partly GM's responsibility?
Well, GM manufactured a support cylinder that worked. It holds up the lid. There's no evidence in the case that this was a design flaw or that there's anything wrong with the support cylinders as they were manufactured.
Well, Mr. Mirabella says there I don't want to put words in his mouth, but basically they broke sooner than they should have broken, and that they broke around this collar ring.
Well, he says that, but he didn't have any expert testimony to support what he says, and that's why that appellate issue fails. He didn't have a proper instruction, and he didn't have any evidence to support the instruction that he tendered.
Well, what about, I mean, he told us about Mr. Gay said it was an unusually high failure rate. I mean, the standard just seems to be pretty low to say, I'll let it go to the jury here. I mean, didn't he put on, isn't there some evidence? I understand you strongly disagree that it was sufficient, but isn't there some evidence of GM's negligence here?
No, there was no evidence that GM was negligent. There was evidence that possibly a prior user of the vehicle was negligent because he forced the trunk lid open so hard that he broke the support cylinders, which is not easy to do.
Did someone testify to that?
Mr. Day testified that the way you break these is you force the trunk lid open to the point where they snap. And that makes a noise. And Mr. Lang said he didn't hear a noise or hear the thing fall into the tray after it broke, so he's pretty sure he didn't break them. So that means that they let this car off the lot after inspecting it twice. And you'd have to know what you're looking for when you're inspecting, because if you just look at the trunk when it's open, as you saw in the video, you don't notice, hey, the support cylinder's not in the up position, you just see the trunk lid's open. But if you had it on a checklist, you would look for it, find it, and correct it. They don't have it on their checklist. It's not on the checklist, so nobody looks for it.
So, Mr. Case, what about the testimony specifically that Judge Gabriel was asking about regarding the unusually high failure rate of the trunk struts? Why is that not sufficient to present a jury question?
Well, there was no evidence of what a usual failure rate is or what an unusual failure rate is. They ran 7,500 rental cars through that lot, and they had six trunk lid strut failures over a one-year period. I don't think that's a very high failure rate. And it's their responsibility to inspect the vehicles. It isn't GM's responsibility to run out and make sure every car gets fixed. It's their responsibility. They're renting the car. They're assuring the customer it's in good condition. All they had to do is look in the trunk, and they would have seen it, but they didn't.
Well, what you're arguing right now is certainly Alamo's liability, and obviously there was, that went to the jury. But on the question of GM, that did not go to the jury. And the question as to the relative liability of each, the jury never got to do that. They didn't get to do it because the judge determined there was no evidence upon which the jury could reach that verdict. What is the failure in their evidence? Mr. Mirabella has said it's a GM car. This is GM original parts. The part failed sooner than a part of that sort should fail. It caused the failure, caused the injury. What's wrong with that? Why isn't that enough?
Because there was no testimony that it should, that it was sooner than that part should fail. There was no testimony about how the part was built or how long it should last or why it should be expected to last or how much force it takes to break it. It was just a complete absence of evidence.
Can the jury, with their common experience, simply know that a part shouldn't break within 20,000 miles and limited usage for 6 months or 8 months and 20,000 miles? Is that not enough for a jury?
No, it's not, Your Honor, in my opinion.
Okay. Right. Let me ask you, Mr. Case, I know you're going to go about another 2 minutes and then cede to Mr. Sure. Plank, and if you want to defer this question to him, that's fine, too. I'll tell you the issue from your side that concerns me probably more than anything here is the juror misconduct issue, and I would appreciate your addressing that. I guess it comes down, is this case more like Destination Travel or Kendrick? From your position, I guess you say this is more like Kendrick, and I guess I'm not sure why. And so maybe it's an issue. What is extraneous prejudicial information? Why wasn't this specialized information that this juror brought to the table? So you can either address that or defer to Mr. Plank.
Well, I'm going to defer it, but I wanted to get my own two cents in. The juror, Mr. Robinson, was an IT tech, and his wife was an airline pilot. So he was concerned with safety. And what I overheard with him and Mr. Mirabella after the trial was a discussion about whether these are conveniences or safety devices. Now, they produced an expert who said, you can alter this computer record. And what Mr. Robinson said is, I think that record was altered because I agree with that expert. You can alter these computer records. All he did was agree on the basis of his experience as an IT person that you can alter computer records after they've been made. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Case.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Martin Plank, registration 19928, and I appreciate your attention with this case. As a preparatory matter, it should be noted that the jury instructions given to this jury contained CJ 4 sections 3.7, 3.8, 3.9, and that instruction, which was contained in jury instruction number 4, but that contains instructions that this jury was only to look to the evidence that was submitted to them. There is a presumption under Colorado law that that jury followed the instructions, and more specifically, as to the facts in this case, the record proves that they follow the instruction. At issue here is Rule 606B. I'll save reading it verbatim to the court, but there are a number of noted commentators that have provided guidance in interpreting the rule. Specifically, Judge Gabriel, in a 1996 Colorado Lawyer article, concerning the competency of jurors as witnesses, provides a very solid foundation for interpreting the rule. Quoting from the article, the purpose of the rule is to promote, quote, freedom of deliberation by the jury, stability in the judicial process, the finality of verdicts, and the protection of jurors against annoyances and embarrassment. Judge Gabriel cited the case of Reef Schneider versus City and County of Denver is authority for the statement. Now, the courts in Colorado have been clear that a juror may not be called to testify about the juror's thought processes during deliberation. Judge Gilman's order denying the appellant's motion for a new trial was correct and should be affirmed. Namely, accepting the hearsay affidavit of appellant's counsel as being factually accurate, it does not give rise to one of the three exceptions found in the rule. A review of the record proves this point. As Mr. Case just mentioned, appellant's expert testified that this computer record could be altered. You can look at the testimony, I believe it's on page 798 of the trial transcript. The jurors questioned that exact issue in juror question number one to the court. Therefore, the record, as opposed to the affidavit of the counsel, clearly reflects that the jurors are addressing the evidence that was presented at trial. So there can be no outside prejudicial issue here. The issue then is whether Mr. Robinson, who was the juror foreman, his professional experience could be considered extraneous, prejudicial information. The answer is in the negative. And the appellant's reliance upon both Kendrick and destination is misplaced, in my opinion. The Kendrick case, which is now before the Supreme Court on certiorari, held that a engineer in providing mathematical and physical or physics information to its fellow jurors did not violate Rule 606B. That's the holding in Kendrick. Carrell, and we cited in our brief, there are five cases that Carrell has held that deal with extraneous prejudicial information. The facts in this case are clearly distinguishable from those five cases that we cited. The reliance upon destination travel, which has been criticized by another panel in the Kendrick case, is distinguishable by the facts in this case, in that in the destination travel case, you had a juror who took evidence that was not submitted to the jury. He implied his own knowledge of what business transactions are and imputed a damage figure as to what the plaintiff's damages were in that case.
So here, Mr. Plank, and I think I'm understanding the distinction you're making. If there were no evidence, if the defendant did not put on an expert, let's say, so there's nothing like that, and then this expert or the foreman said, you know, I'm an IT expert, and I think they could, you know, monkey with this document, that might be a problem under destination travel. But your position in Mr. Case's, as I understand it, is we don't have to get there. They had an expert who said you can monkey with this document, and the IT guy said, you know, based on my experience, I think that's right. And so we don't even have to get there. Is that your position?
That is exactly it, Your Honor. Judge Gilman, in her ruling, said none of the three exceptions apply, and we would concur with that ruling and would ask this court to affirm that ruling.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Plank.
Thank you.
Since we went to the jury misconduct issue and I didn't talk about it in my initial presentation, I guess the point that I would have to make to you is that not only did Mr. Hankins testify that, yeah, you can go through and change this, you have to go through all these, you have to have access to the database, you have to be a person high enough up in the air in the organization that you get access to the database. You can't just log into a laptop, use somebody else's number, and go in and monkey with it. There's a large number of steps you have to do it.
So what information did the juror bring to bear here that expert didn't say? I understand everything you just said.
I wasn't quite finished.
Oh, I apologize.
The only thing he said was, if somebody did it, there'd be evidence that it happened. And I've looked at the entire electronic record, and it did not happen. And that's what this juror did, was he said, despite the testimony, that the unrebutted testimony, that it did not happen, I believe it could have happened and did in fact happen. And that's the difference. That's why it really falls outside of Kendrick and into destination travel. The other point that I would make is that I think Kendrick is improperly decided. I understand it is the law, pending whatever the Supreme Court does with it. But it doesn't take a lot of imagination to see how even in a mathematical calculation, a professional is going to throw their own mix into it. If I'm on a jury, I've done a bunch of trials. I know how to do net present value calculation. I have an accounting degree. I think the expert's selection of a 2% discount rate is wrong. I'm going to make it 4%. I'm going to make it 0.5%. And the jury goes with me because I'm a lawyer and I'm an accountant and I know what I'm doing. It doesn't take a lot of imagination to figure out how that's going to be wrong.
Is there an indication in your affidavit or the affidavit that was given to the trial court as to what he said beyond, based on my IT experience, I think it was tampered with, and that he expressed that opinion to the rest of the jury based on my IT experience, I think it was tampered with?
I believe what I put in my affidavit and all him saying to me, and Mr. Case is correct. We talked about safety when Mr. Case was standing there. I don't recall if Mr. Case was standing there when we talked about the IT issue, but he said, if we had found that this was an authentic document, then we would have put substantial liability on Mr. Lang because we would have believed that he knew about it. The kind of odd thing is that if they believe that was a forgery, there's not one piece of evidence that shows that National knew there was a problem with it until he returns the car.
No, but my concern is this. Judge Gilman had in front of her the affidavit you submitted.
Yes.
And she had to make a determination based on that affidavit.
Yes.
And in accordance with that affidavit, what did the juror say that came from outside?
His opinion as to the validity of the Exhibit A.
So he expressed his opinion based on his experience that this was done later. This was, okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mirabella. Thank you again, Mr. Case and Mr. Plank. We appreciate all of your arguments this morning in this case. We found them helpful.